Women are one of the fastest growing prisoner populations in the world. Who are these women who are being incarcerated and what are their stories? What can their experiences tell us about our criminal justice system and society as a whole? Carlene Faith sheds some light on these questions in her new book, 13 Women, Parables from Prison. Carlene has been an activist and an advocate for prisoners' rights for over 30 years. The book 13 Women is a compilation of stories of women that Carlene has met and interviewed over those 30 years. Carlene joins us on the phone from her home in Vancouver to talk to us more about her book, 13 Women, Parables from Prison. Thanks for joining us, Carlene. Good to have you on the show.
Oh, thanks for asking.
Can you start by telling us more about how this book came to be?
When I first went into the women's prison in California in 1972, I had already been doing a lot of prison work in other places, including teaching men. And when I was in Soledad Prison, in the men's maximum security prison, teaching a class, I had a really interesting conversation one day with them about where the women were, because they would make reference to sisters and wives and mothers and daughters who were in prison, but they didn't have a clue where that prison was. And they said, go find the women. And that's just exactly what I did. And when I got to the Southern California prison for women, there were 600 women there, and I was able to get permission to interview everybody. And I did interview many, many women, probably 200 in the whole big picture of things at that time. And I interviewed them with very specific questions in mind, having to do with what kind of educational background they had had. But what I was really interested in were the details of the stories that they just started telling in, it was almost a frenzy of stories being told, because these women had never really had anybody ask them anything about their own lives, and they were very eager to tell their own truths and to have their stories known. So that was the beginning of it for me, was just simply listening to their stories. And over the years, of course, I just continued to accumulate these stories. So finally, although I had started this project many years ago before coming back home to Canada and before working at SFU, I had begun the process of editing some of these stories. But once I got into the university, I was so busy doing the kind of work that I needed to do there, which continued to include a lot of prison research. But the stories just sort of languished on a shelf until, even as I was continuing to accumulate them, until finally I retired and thought, okay, now finally, here we come. Here are the women and their stories. So it's sort of full circle for me. It's sort of like ending at the beginning.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the range of stories that can be found in the book?
It includes stories by women who have been involved in the conventional crimes, and by that I mean women who were arrested for drug possession, for petty theft, for welfare fraud. And then it also includes women who have been involved in really tragic circumstances that resulted in violence against someone. One of the most poignant stories in the book is about a young woman who was a stepmother to a little boy who died, partly because she got violent with him one evening when she was just absolutely at her wit's end. And then her husband came home and proceeded to be violent against his son as well. And so that poor little boy died. And it was a really difficult story to hear, and it was a really difficult story to edit so that everybody else could read this story as well, to make it short enough but still clear enough about the circumstances in which that could happen. And I now feel very, very strongly that we not only need child care programs, but we really do need assistance for parents who are just at the end of their rope, who are absolutely exhausted or, as in her case, really sick and simply don't have the wherewithal, the emotional or the physical endurance to cope with the demands of having young children. In her case, she had three very tiny kids, and she just couldn't cope, and she lost her temper, and this poor little child died as a result. That's an unusual crime. There were 600 women in the prison at that time, and there were only four women who were in prison for having harmed a child. Two of them hadn't themselves actually harmed a child. They had been convicted of it because they had neglected or failed to protect their child against an abusive partner. But it is an unusual crime, but I thought it was an important story to include because even in a case of violence where someone dies, whether a child or another adult, there are always reasons behind it. There's always a way to look at that woman's life and say, well, yeah, I can understand how that would have happened. She wasn't a bad person. She wasn't a monster. But horrible things were happening to her, and now horrible things are the consequence of her suffering. So I did include stories that include crimes of violence, even though women are charged with no more than, at the most, in any given year, any place, almost 15% of all crimes of violence are convictions of women.
That's a lot of what you see in the mainstream media is those sensational, more violent, more sort of dramatic crimes. And I'm just wondering if you could comment on how your book plays a role in countering some of that sensationalism that can be found in the mainstream.
Yeah, it is a really big problem that the media, and I suppose quite naturally, it's not difficult to understand because they want to sell their story, whether it's print media or electronic, but it's true that they always hone in on those cases where a woman has committed violence. And it seems to happen concurrently with anti-feminism. There's a very strong attitude of a liberated woman is a dangerous woman, and that attitude remarkably has not shifted all that much in the hundred and, well, certainly more than 100 or a few hundred years since women have been trying to achieve genuine equality, but certainly since the women's movement became a major social force in the late 1960s and early 1970s, that mythology has been especially strong, that the presumption that if women achieve liberation, women will become more violent. That simply isn't the case. That isn't borne out by any facts or any studies or any surveys at all. But it's one that the media picks up on and treats as if it is a fact. So I'm pleased you brought that up because it is. It's just a chronic misrepresentation of who the women are who go to prison. They certainly are not violent people, generally speaking. I mean, it's very, very rare.
And as you were mentioning also, maybe you could touch on this a little more, the lack of support systems. Through reading these stories, you can see the impacts on people's lives living without those support systems.
Oh, it's totally true. I'm looking here at the table of contents. The very first woman who I'm presenting in this book was also the first woman that I interviewed. I was at that time, as I previously mentioned, working in a men's prison. She knew that I was doing research. I was going to conferences and to meetings and to rallies that had to do with defending prisoners' human rights. And I was observing that there weren't any women on the scene, so I was very pleased when she called me because, like I say, I was out searching for the women. And she heard about me and about my work, and she came to see me, and we did a really, I thought, for her, a really brave interview where she talked about having been arrested for having been misled by an individual who she thought was a friend who got her to buy a lid of marijuana. It turned out this so-called friend was an undercover police, and she got arrested and sent to prison for 3 years. And in the process, she lost her family. Her children ended up being taken care of by other members of her family because when she got out after 3 years, they didn't know her. She tried to commit suicide. She was locked in solitary for having attempted suicide. Her life was really destroyed. And her life was destroyed because she was a young, very poetic hippie, is what she was. And she ended up really having her life just terribly assaulted by the state. So that was the first case. But then I look at the others. Angelique, she was just a very beautiful woman who had some very interesting stories. She committed some really outrageous robberies and smuggling and whatnot. She was just a really interesting outlaw kind of person. But she had been very badly battered as a child, very badly abused, and there was no support for that, not even for talking about it. Another story, a woman named Leah, was on welfare, and she was not able to support her family and to feed her family and pay the rent for her family while on welfare. So she cheated by getting welfare from more than one county. She was caught, and she ended up having to do many years in prison. And clearly, we are very, as a society, we really just are not in any way being realistic about what a woman needs to handle all the expenses of life when she has children. So the welfare system in Canada today is absolutely no better than the welfare system that Leah suffered in California many years ago, and which resulted in her also having her family pretty much destroyed by that. Kathy, I mentioned, whose child died, she certainly needed a support system that she did not have, that there was no service available at all in her community to support parents who were just too harassed to carry on. I mean, there are all these various stories here. There's Norma, who is a woman who was expelled from nursing school just before graduation because they discovered she was a lesbian. The administration did, so they just simply expelled her. They didn't want any lesbians in their nursing school. So social attitudes certainly are very, very primary features of why a woman does or does not end up in prison.
And in terms of those stories, there's also a couple of women in the book who have been put in prison for political motivated crimes. Can you tell us more about their stories?
Yeah, I'm really very pleased to have those stories in particular in this book. The three women let me just preface that by saying that of all the stories in the book, the 13 stories, five of them are Canadian stories, and of those stories, three of them are very solid political stories. And people will be very familiar with these women. One is Anne Hansen, who was involved in what got called by the media the Squamish Five. Another is Betty Krajcik, who is very well known in British Columbia as the woman who is now in her late 70s, who goes into the rainforest and the old growth forests and lays her body on the line to prevent the trucks from coming in and clear-cutting these precious forests. And the third woman is Christine Lamont, who was jailed in Brazil for 10 years for her activism against U.S. imperialism. So those three women all went to prison because they were working very, very hard against the kind of social injustices and inequalities that result in so many women going to prison. They themselves broke the law in order to try to defend human rights, and in the process, they themselves were imprisoned. But their stories are very enlightening, I think, about the work and the courage and the commitment of people who are really determined to have a more just society and are willing to take whatever steps they have to take to draw considerable public attention toward those kinds of issues, the issues of imperialism and the issues of environmental destruction and of pornography and war culture. They were very, very, they're all extremely smart women, and they were all extremely courageous women, and I'm just really so pleased that they've written their stories. They're really so eloquent, all of those women.
What kind of similarities or differences did you notice in their experience of their imprisonment in comparison to the other stories that you've collected?
Well, the prisons, of course, are the same, no matter what prisons you're looking at or where or when. There's just a fundamental quality to imprisonment. Namely, you've got one set of people with the keys and the other set of people who they are locking up. So the prison experience is not necessarily different. But I don't know that I can answer that question. Do you have an answer? There might be an answer. It's not occurring to me. I mean, certainly it's a different situation if you go into prison for doing something that you believe in, that you're really basing your actions on your convictions. That's a very different thing from going to prison because of some horrible unintended accident that happens, or because you are possessing a drug, or because you are stealing to feed your kids. Those are very different life circumstances, so the state of mind of the individual is, of course, going to be quite different. And certainly, the three women that I spoke of who were in prison as political prisoners, certainly they all had very, very good attitudes, and they were all they are when they are in prison. That is to say, Betty has still been in prison just up to not so long ago, and who knows if she'll have to go back. One always prays not, but she really is a very determined protector of the forest, so one never knows. But at any rate, they do take on a certain leadership quality. Other women, certainly in all three of these cases, have looked up to these women, and that has been true very commonly in North America with political prisoners, that they tend to be women who have such a strong social conscience and relate so in such a loving and committed way to other human beings and to human rights that they do tend to be looked up to by the other women. That's certainly true. There's also a chapter in here about First Nations women, and that in Canada is, of course, the most crucial and glaring feature of our prison system in this country, is that it is far too overpopulated with First Nations people. And First Nations women especially are very vulnerable to incarceration. So it's a very, very serious issue. And in this chapter, I cover a lot of the issues that deal with how colonization has resulted in this kind of what ultimately is a very racist practice of over-incarcerating First Nations women and men. But it also, I think, speaks to the kind of cultural revival and determination to establish as much autonomy in their lives as they can and to recover their culture and their spirituality and other things which the prison system promises to facilitate, but in fact very often doesn't. There's a tragic aspect to the prison system. It is wherever we're looking, but specifically since we're here in Canada, certainly the racism factor is always looming very large in terms of who gets selected to go to prison, because obviously it's not just breaking the law that qualifies one for prison. You have to be at a particularly low place on the social ladder or you're not going to get locked up, with some exceptions, very rare.
What other themes do you feel that are important that come across in these stories in your book?
Well, each story, see, I just love these stories. These women are just such beautiful women. They have such a lovely way of being humble in a way that isn't any kind of false modesty or anything, but they really are very, very talented women. One of the things that always strikes me in all the prisons that I have visited and all the, by now, many hundreds of women that I have gotten to know who have been incarcerated is that there's really, I think, an exceptional number of people who go to prison who are extremely talented, sometimes with very short attention spans, or maybe the drugs that they were using caused them lapses of judgment, or I mean there are all sorts of ways of explaining how it is that they happen to get into prison. But nevertheless, I'm just so always impressed with how much intelligence that you find, how much talent, how many really extraordinary people end up in prison. So no matter which of these stories that one might look at, you're going to find really, really interesting people. And that's what I love about the book, is just that they have such interesting stories. And they do humanize the criminal justice system so much. They're not just another part of another dry statistical set of data that we can, you know, mull over in an academic way or tisk tisk in a political indignation. They are really rich with human insight and with character, very strong human character. These are not people to just dismiss. And this, of course, is just a little teeny sampling of that. But it could have been really 13 very different stories, and it would have that same range of a very, very interesting, worthwhile human being who ends up being degraded and humiliated and put through all sorts of tortuous exercises as a prisoner. It's a very bad system. The whole prison system is bad. And if there is a single theme that I hope stays with the reader, it is that it is just nonsense to be spending up to $100,000 per year per woman to keep her locked up. That's a travesty. We shouldn't, as a society, even begin to tolerate that kind of a silliness. It's just a ridiculousness when you think about what could be done for a woman in her life who had to steal to feed her kids, what could be done with $100,000 a year. The idea of just using that money to pay somebody else's salary to keep her locked up is well, to my mind, it's preposterous. So I definitely come through this book as a very, very strong opponent of the prison system as we know it.
Have you heard of much response to the book?
I have. It's only been out for a while, but certainly I'm getting very positive responses. I'm just delighted with that. It's really lovely to know that these women did not tell their story in vain, that there are people who are really paying attention to what they're reading in each of these stories and really learning a lot about the prison system, because it's certainly, I think, the best way to know what that is all about is to listen to somebody describe the years that they lived there. So they are the experts about criminal justice.
You must have gone through quite the process to take those hundreds of stories and put it into a book. I understood you worked with Ann Neer a little bit.
Yes,
on that process too.
Yeah, I had a friend in California, Ann Neer, who actually, we intended to do the book in 1980. That's when I began doing it. But then I got the job up at SFU, and we had to just put it on the shelf. But it was a long process, but it mostly wasn't happening. That is to say, I just had all these stories. I had crates of them. I'm still in the process of going through literally hundreds and thousands, in fact, of files of all kinds of prison-related data, including these personal interview transcriptions. And there's just no end to it. That's what I was saying a minute ago, that it doesn't really matter. It could be almost any random 13 women, and it would be full of very rich information and analysis about what punishment is all about in a North American society. What do we really mean when we put somebody in prison? What are we trying to communicate to them or to society? The idea, one would think, would be to protect society, but it doesn't seem that there's any need to protect anybody. Certainly not from these women. They're not running around amok trying to harm anybody at all.
Well, thank you.
You go.
No. Did you have something else to add there?
Well, no. I'm just still racking my brain because you want to hear about the process, but I don't really know how to do that. The process for me was just simply listening to these stories. That was the beauty of it, and it wasn't just passively sitting there. It was an active interchange between me and the women that I was speaking with, but. For me, that's where my head goes when I think, what was your process? Well, my process was being really receptive to hearing what they had to say and feeling really good in terms of my own role in all this to have the opportunity to be able to present their stories, to be in a position to be able to edit the book and to locate a publisher who has been wonderful. Douglas and McIntyre published the book. They have offices in Vancouver, and they were just really a wonderful publisher. I was so pleased with the cover we ended up with, and they were willing, after some negotiation, to print photos of the women whose photos I had. And so the whole process for me is one of privilege. That is privilege to be able to be the messenger, to be able to say, look, these women gave me their lives, they gave me these stories, and I think other people are going to want to read them and hear about them. And to have that accepted, and to have people then reading this book and taking these stories to heart, and in many cases getting in touch with me or the publisher, and conveying their appreciation for being able to demystify who these so-called criminals are. And one quickly finds that whole stereotype of a criminal just simply doesn't hold up, that these are the people in our lives. These are people that we see on the street, and we just simply are not aware that they have such really remarkable stories to tell. And now here there are some, 13 of them.
Well, I just wanted to say thanks very much for retiring and finding the time to put the book together.
You're so welcome.
Because I think it's fabulous, and I would encourage everyone to find a copy of it. Well, thanks very much for speaking with us this evening and sharing a little bit about the process and about the stories that we can find in your book.
Well, you're so welcome.
We have been speaking with Carlene Faith, and she just put out a new book called 13 Women, Parables from Prison. Carlene has been an activist, scholar, and advocate for prisoners' human rights for over 30 years.